Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday. It's the 15th of December. We're halfway through the final month of calendar year 2025, and it is very nice to be with you. You know, I remember a time. I'll sound like my parents. I'm old enough to remember a time when Mondays were boring in the news business and there was nothing going on. Well, not today. A lot going on, and we'll get to a good deal of it as we work our way through the stories this morning, and a lot of tragedy in the news today. So we will we'll work our way through that as well. But while we certainly will and can fret and focus on these tragic stories, I would like to just a couple of rays of sunshine that are with us. First of all, coming up at 11 o'clock, we have an amazing special. We've been playing the special for, I believe, as long as I have been here. It is a Hanukkah special. It is called Candles Burning Brightly. Mindy Ratner is the host. It is a beautiful special and one that our audiences very much look forward to, and we'll be airing it in our 11 o'clock hour. So I do hope you will join us for that. Also, Fred Hoff is back. I have missed Fred. I can't tell you how much I have missed Fred Hoff. I love all of our panelists, but Fred has been out for a little bit, and so Ambassador Fred Hoff is back, and you have been literally all over the world since you have last been here.
Yeah, the last few months I've been rattling around the Middle East trying to do good works.
All right. So, is there anything you can share with us as your ideas, your perceptions, your thoughts on the situations that you've run into over the last several weeks?
Yeah, Joe, my work is in the category of what's called track two diplomacy, unofficial diplomacy, trying to tee up issues for officials to address, and my work is focused on Lebanon and Israel. Been shuttling back and forth between Beirut, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, trying to bring about circumstances where a very violent ceasefire can be replaced by something that actually ultimately leads to peace between these people. We've been making some progress, but we've submitted our report, and I'm delighted to be back. I've truly missed the drive up the thruway.
Well, we've missed you, and we're very glad you're back, especially for the holidays. And thank you so much for not only being with us, but for the incredible, amazing work that you're doing on the behalf of all of us. We'll talk a little bit more about it later, but that is quite extraordinary, and we just thank you for being here, and we're glad you're safe and sound and with us once again. We also welcome this morning Senior Fellow of Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, is here. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Yeah. You didn't ask the question of how he's doing. I noticed that.
Hmm?
You didn't answer the question of how you're doing, so I'll take that.
Oh, I said happy. I'm happy to be here.
Okay. I'll take that as the answer, actually.
There's a lot of heavy news to talk about, looking forward to talking about it with this august group.
We have an amazing panel today. Catherine Tan is with us, associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College. Good morning, Catherine. A delight to have you here, as
always. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And last, certainly not least, never least, is Libby Post, political consultant and lobbyist and our dear, dear friend. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
Well, I'm okay. I've been better. On a bright side, not anything we're going to talk about today, is that today is the day that this big bill that I worked on, the Companion Animal Care Standards Act for shelters and rescues, kicks in. We had a 3-year effective date so that people could do the work they needed to do. Over the 3 years, we raised close to $500,000 in grant funding to provide free consulting services for shelters and rescues across the state. And today's the day, December 15th.
Wow.
The governor signed the bill 3 years ago today. We did the 3-year effective date on purpose. And the first year of the program with Ag and Markets, it's an educational year for everybody, for them and for the shelters and the rescues. Everyone will be all animal welfare organizations that do sheltering of any kind, whether it's foster base or bricks and mortar, will be licensed as animal shelters in the state of New York. They'll all be overseen before. The only shelters that were inspected were municipal shelters and nonprofit shelters with municipal contracts. Now everyone will be, and it's all it is raising the standard of care for homeless companion animals. This bill is based on standards from 2010 from the Association of Shelter Veterinarians, so it's not like, oh, this is brand new stuff. And, you know, we're going to see the animals being better cared for in places that were never overseen before.
Can I just say that I you know, animal welfare issues in general have just improved so much over, I don't know, let's say the last 20 years or something.
Yes.
Just pick a random time. And but it's because of work, like what you're doing, that makes it happen. I think it's also happening worldwide. I mean, I just was back in Egypt, and I've lived in Egypt on and off for about 7 years. And when I first was going there, you could just see animals, street animals, treated so horribly. I mean, just unspeakably horribly. And there really is a movement to address that. And one of my friends at the American University in Cairo is leading that movement, and not just on her own. There's a lot of people doing it. And so I have to think that's happening in lots of other places. There's lots of awareness and efforts. And so thank you for doing that. And I'm happy to see it improving worldwide.
Yeah, in the United States, the conversation shifted from it shifted from you're there for 5 days, a dog is there for 5 days in New York State as an example, a five-day hold for a stray animal, and, well, it's going to be euthanized if nobody comes and picks it up after 5 days. That was de rigueur for a very, very, very long time.
That's it, 5 days?
Yes.
That's ridiculous.
That's the legal standard. Well, it's the law in New York that if they pick up a stray, the owner has 5 days, basically, to come in and redeem the dog. And get a license and all that sort of stuff. And there was a major shift in animal welfare thinking to, this is absurd. You know, we should not be euthanizing for space. Yeah. We should be putting other kinds of programs in place to either help people keep their dogs and their cats, but get them back home, you know, microchipping and licensing. Mm-hmm. And I work for a company called DocuPet that can streamline the licensing process, and they're one of my clients. And it's all of this stuff that has really changed the focus of animal welfare in the United States, and it's become a profession. I wouldn't ask the Trump administration to say it was a profession, but it is a profession, and there are lots of people all over the state who dedicate themselves to enhancing the lives of homeless companion animals so that they can get adopted and have a real forever home.
It also proves just that patience wins out.
Yes,
that
absolutely.
A bill like this takes a long time.
Yeah.
And for it to be what we want it to be,
yes,
it's got to work through the process.
I mean, I started at the Fed in November of 2013, and we were talking about it back then. And then with the puppy mill bill, with the negotiations around that, with the breeders and the pet stores and all that, they were cranking, well, we're inspected and you're not, which was not true. And so we decided instead of having someone try to put their standards on us, we were just going to move ahead with this set of standards. And it passed unanimously in both houses. It's a new chapter of law, Article 26C of the Ag and Markets Law.
Well, so, we congratulate you. And we thank you very much
yes.
for your efforts and the folks responsible for this. It's quite something. All right, let's get to the voluminous news of the day, and we'll get started. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. A trio of huge stories. One, of course, is the death of Hollywood director and actor Rob Reiner and his wife, Michelle, who were found dead in their Los Angeles home yesterday afternoon. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Information is starting to emerge to give us a bit more of a picture of what happened there. Nothing has officially been said or confirmed, but it seems like there is information that's imminent and coming out. So we'll talk about that in a few moments. Also, of course, the shooting in Australia that happened in Bondi Beach, where a Syrian-born Australian who tackled one of the Bondi Beach gunmen is recovering in the hospital. It was a horrible attack, where but a father and a son. Mm-hmm. The father was killed. The son is injured as a result, and it is a tragic, horrible story there as well. At least 15 people killed at a Jewish holiday celebration. More than 36 others were hospitalized, including a surviving suspect. So we will talk about that as well. I would like to begin with the case, and I did not intend to start last night when I was putting the stories together. I didn't intend to start with this story because it seemed like it was coming to some sort of conclusion, at least in the sense of finding the person responsible, and that is the shooting at Brown University over the weekend. And there was a study session going on at Brown University on Saturday, and a gunman went in and killed two people. Several others were injured, including a young woman who was also injured in the Parkland shooting. And good God, you know, you think this could never happen again, and happened twice to this young woman. So they found a person of interest. And yesterday afternoon, there was a lot of information that was coming out about this person. He was from Wisconsin. He was apparently going to be entering the university in the fall, and was interested in, and there was a picture that was emerging about this person. 11 o'clock last night, the police call a press conference, and they say, we've released him. None of the evidence that we had was consistent with what the actual case, and we have released the gunman. So now, pretty much from what we know, and this could be different, of course, but the police are resuming the search and basically are starting from scratch after releasing that person of interest. The authorities say they were renewing their hunt for the gunman who killed two people. And this is, I do not remember a recent case where quite extraordinary, where someone was brought into, was being held, and was believed to be the main suspect, and then just an hour or two later was let go. I will add real quickly before we talk about this that there were some cases of miscommunication early on in the case, where there were reports that came out that the suspect was caught. And that turned out to be not true. That was just in the moments following the shooting. And then later on, there was another dispatch from authorities that there had been another shooting elsewhere on campus. Another not that anyone had been hurt, but there had been another gunfire episode that happened on campus that also turned out not to be true. So there is some inconsistencies in what is happening. Meanwhile, we have gotten to meet the mayor of Providence, Rhode Island, who is omnipresent on television and has been over the last 2 days, Mayor Brett Smiley, who said Sunday night that officials had no way of knowing if the attacker, who killed at least two students and injured nine others in the attack on Saturday, was still in the city of Providence or not. Jim.
Well, I really do. I'm glad you were pointing out that there's been so much misinformation, because this is standard with these kinds of attacks and these kinds of incidents. But there's always this tension between a rush to get out as much information as possible and then a dearth of good and solid information. And so that means that all kinds of bad information gets out. And then there's always some people who want to stir the pot and send it along, including apparently the President of the United States, who decided to be live tweeting the incident as well, which I think is highly counterproductive, and is irresponsible, actually. And so I think that in all of these cases, it you know, news organizations have to do what they do, but I think it behooves us to just take a deep breath and try to say, okay, let's really find out what the hard facts are and see where they take us, because you know, any of these cases are going to have so many you know, leads that don't work out and dead ends and pieces of information that just aren't true, particularly when you have now you still have a suspect on the loose and you have people you know, who are traumatized. I mean, a whole campus, a whole city that is traumatized. So, you know, short of that, on the way in today, I was thinking about this case and about the Australia case, too. I've been on this program so many times the day after there's been such a case, and you just kind of run out of things to say. I mean, run out of ways to express you know, sadness and frustration that things don't get addressed, that things don't get better.
Well, here, things don't get better. Already, Australia is stepping forward and saying, well, we're going to tighten gun laws mm-hmm. even more, which is something the United States does not do after a tragic shooting, right? This is... this year alone, 2025, we have had 75 school shootings, 43 of these on college campuses, and it's just been increasing precipitously over the last 20 years. Looking at this more broadly, we've had 391 mass shootings. I believe mass shootings defined as five or more victims. It is absolutely outrageous, right? The United States we are constantly being tested and constantly failing each one of these tests. I mean, something should have been done after Sandy Hook. That was, you know, that was a bunch of children, and we didn't do anything then. And so it's exhausting. After, you know, as you said, you've been on this show after a tragic shooting multiple times, and it's really wild and frustrating that the leaders in our country are not doing anything. Right? It's not just tragic. I mean, the deaths are tragic, but this is really just enraging. I don't know what other word to say. Like, you know, the United States, I think we are, we have 13 times more like gun deaths compared to our peer countries. And what is it? I saw an outrageous fact yesterday when I was looking up gun stats for our country. 46%, so almost half of civilian-owned guns of the world are owned by Americans. Isn't that crazy?
And I just want to say one thing, too, about gun violence. So these kinds of incidents, you know, focus us on the use of guns and the outbreak of violence across mm-hmm. the country. But despite that really chilling set of facts that you just gave us, Catherine, most of the gun violence is just kind of day to day to day mm-hmm. and gets very little attention. About a third of it is people who are using guns to commit suicide.
Yeah.
Another third are people who are using guns in domestic violence cases. Mm-hmm. And another third are people who are using guns in the commission of crime here, there, and everywhere.
Yeah.
And not these kind of mass shooting crimes, but, you know, other sorts of crimes. And each of those requires not only, you know, rethinking, you know, how available guns are, but each of them requires a different policy focus. And those numbers haven't gone down. They've gone up year after year after year. So there is an inability to kind of, you know, focus on it until there's one of these mass shootings. We focus on it for about 12 hours and move on.
Yeah, it's outrageous how quickly we move. But you're right. Like, there are so many gun deaths that do not make it to the news, right? In the U.S., just this year, we've had close to 14,000 gun deaths. But you don't hear about all 14,000 cases. You hear about the big ones. But even those don't really stick in the news cycle for very long because we've become desensitized to it, which is really, that's awful.
I mean, that idea of desensitizing. I mean, it just strikes me that the three top stories that we're talking about as of right now involve four individuals who decided that the way to answer the problems that they had personally was through violence, whether it was through a knife attack or gun, and whether it was political or not. It is that prevalence of violence, and mm-hmm. that we do become desensitized to the fact that we're killing each other over whatever these reasons, and mm-hmm. each one has its own reasons, but it's still a head scratcher to figure out of why that's the go-to. Fred Hoff.
Yeah, I guess I would definitely agree with Catherine. I thought that Sandy Hook would be the thing that would cause decisive change. Mm-hmm. Legislatively on this issue in the United States. If something like Sandy Hook doesn't do it, what in the world could change our approach on this problem?
And just for context, and I'm sure most people obviously know about this case, but this is where a young man goes into a kindergarten in first grade and kills young innocent children, and not only did nothing change, but we also the ripples of that story. What were the ripples of that story? I mean, certainly the families, certainly trying to get meaning gun legislation, but then you have somebody, like Alex Jones
making an enormous amount of money,
saying that it was a false flag operation,
yeah.
and the government was behind
yeah.
it. And I mean, if there's anything more sickening than the crime itself, it's that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yesterday was Sandy Hook's 13th anniversary.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Okay. And I also agree with Catherine. It reflects tremendous failure on the part of our leadership. But it also, more than that, it reflects tremendous failure on the part of us mm-hmm. as citizens. I have four grandsons in elementary school these days, and I worry about the threat. I'm very concerned about the various drills they have to go through in school. I have to wonder why is my worry mm-hmm. not universal in this country? If our legislators are going to do anything about this problem, it's because they will be reacting to demand from their constituents that something can be done. Mm-hmm. Why is this not universal? Why is it that tens of millions of American voters don't seem to care about this issue? Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that apathy or even hostility toward the control of high-powered weaponry, mm-hmm. it's just causing our Congress to do nothing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think people do care, but it really tells us like what our leaders value, right? And or rather, the human life that they devalue, and that is the part that is really shocking. We're the only ones with this problem, right? You look at the rest of the world, it's really just us in high-income countries who are that is dealing with this problem over and over again and not really doing anything about it.
Libby?
Well, you know, the NRA is a very powerful lobby. You mm-hmm. know, it used to be the NRA was all about responsible use of your guns, and we'll do workshops and we'll tell you how to load them, we'll tell you how to lock them up, we'll tell you how to do all this. And then they became the mouthpiece for the gun manufacturers.
Mm-hmm.
And they've pumped a lot of money into Republican coffers, and they have pitched the government's going to come and take away your guns, right? That the fear mongering around that. And it just, everything just keeps multiplying and people just buy more guns. I think that there are more guns owned in the United States than there are people. I think that there's a figure out there.
I remember that.
You know, and that's really bizarre when you think about it, that, you know, you can walk into somebody's household and they have an arsenal that's legal, that's licensed. It's very, very bizarre. And you know, what happened in Sandy Hook, you would think something would have happened. What happened at Parkland, you'd think something would have happened legislatively. But the Republicans are in the pocket of corporate America and the gun manufacturers. In this case, the NRA has been proven to be less than stellar and trustworthy. But this whole notion that my right to bear arms, mm-hmm. everybody forgets the rest of it, which is for a well-regulated militia, right? Not for you being able to go out, buy as many guns you want, and then when you're not happy, go and shoot people up.
And I don't understand why there isn't. Okay, so people are allowed to bear arms, allowed to own guns. Why isn't there more regulation around how many you can own? There's no reason why people should own that many. It was 3% of Americans own half of all civilian-owned guns in the U.S. 3%. What the hell are they doing?
And they let the automatic weapon ban
right.
expire.
Well, and that's the key.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
the, it's the type of
yeah.
of weapon.
The AR-15s,
I personally don't care if a neighbor of mine owns 24 shotguns. I don't care. If he owns a semi-automatic
mm-hmm.
weapon
mm-hmm.
That is most suitable for military use, then I care. Those of us who served in the military know how dangerous mm-hmm. these things are, which is why they get locked up in the armory overnight.
Right.
You don't take them home with you.
My brother, a Marine, yeah. that's what he always says to me. He said, look, they gave them to us. We knew how to take them apart, put them back together
Absolutely.
Again. Take them apart,
yep.
put them back together again.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, they took them from us and they locked them up.
Yep.
But I think that we're wrong in thinking that this is a policy issue solely, or that it's a constitutional issue. It really seems to me to break along the lines of many things in our polarized society today, and a lot of this. Gun ownership, the worry that the government's going to come and take your guns, going to come and take the shotguns. I mean, I grew up in a house where, you know, there was hunting, there yeah. were guns, they were just kind of tools. But it has become part of a deeper question of identity and an alignment with a whole set of views and positions that are way beyond just kind of, you know, policy prescriptions. And it's way beyond the NRA, which I think has fallen on hard times, actually, that this is, you know, the product of so many other things that beset our society. It's one of the ones that comes to mind when we see this kind of outbreak of violence, but it's part and parcel of a deeper societal problem. The way that people take political positions is an outgrowth of these deeper identity issues and their resistance to having their what they see as their identity attacked by those who they don't agree with.
And this is when sensible policies should just be imposed, right? Like I absolutely understand. Like this is a part of people's identity, but there are limits to these things. You know, you can't just own a bunch of guns because you feel that it is part of your value system when, you know, people are getting hurt and thousands upon thousands of people are killed every year.
But we do have a gun culture in this country, and we do have and that has been politicized. Excuse me. And also. God, I wish we had a sociologist on the program.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's it, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
cultures can change.
Yes.
You know, and it is something that is absolutely malleable. I mean, gelatinous foods used to be part of our culture, right?
Oh, you mean Jello? Yes.
Right, but no,
they're
but it's.
But my question would be
Jello's always a part of my diet.
Yeah, exactly.
People who have identity issues, of which one may be firearms and the right to bear them, do they not worry about their kids and grandkids?
Yeah, but Fred, there's if right now while we're having this conversation. If and I don't recommend that you change the radio station, but if you did change the radio station to a different kind of radio station, there's a very different conversation going on right now about this very same incident. And people will say, yes, we care about our children, and but you know the left is going to use this as an excuse to take our guns, to take our ammunition. This is a problem of people. It's not a problem of guns. And we need to address the people who do these things. And then you head down a very dark path about who those people are and who needs to be singled out, et cetera. So, you know, there are different information spheres. People live in their own information bubbles, and the people who are having those different conversations, maybe some of them are listening to WAMC right now, and I urge you to write into us and tell us your point of view on this. Mm-hmm. But I think most of them are listening to a different radio station and having a different conversation.
Yeah, but facts are facts, right? Like,
well,
we
maybe.
Are... maybe. Well,
yeah.
These days.
So said...
Yeah.
But, you know, if guns are supposed to make us safer, right, are supposed to protect us, why is the country with the highest number of gun ownership the least safe, has the highest number of gun deaths? Like, those are just the facts. And I understand, you know, my cousin, her ex-husband was a gun nut. And so I understand this perspective quite well. Like, there's this fear that, oh, we have to be, you know, armed because, you know, the government might turn on us. And but at the end of the day, you have to, I mean, I don't think you can change individuals' minds. I think if that's what people, that's the idea that people are operating with, I think it's really difficult to change their minds. But I don't think, I think by changing policies and tightening regulation over time, we can change the culture and people's attitudes around this. You know, once you see gun deaths decreasing, right? Like, I think people over time will change their perspective.
Well, I guarantee really you, because I've heard it before, one of the things that people will say in the wake of Sandy Hook or Parkland or Brown University is we need a good guy with a gun in the right place.
Yeah,
we need armed people in our schools. We need armed people on our campuses. We need armed people in our public places. Those people, a good guy with a gun, will protect people. That, I mean, you have to. I think not you individually. One has to. Realize that this conversation is not necessarily the predominant narrative that people are, how people are reacting to these kinds of incidents.
And still, I go back to, and I mentioned one, but there are actually two students who were present for a shooting in their high school with casualties, one shot in high school. And then only to have this happen and be at another, or to go to college, and through the trauma of all that, go to college and have another school shooting take place. And it's just, I mean, to me, that's more than anecdotal. That really does show you that this is a cyclical problem and is impacting people deeply.
And what does that do to the developing brains and emotional well-being of all these kids? Are not even of course the ones who have been through these tragic incidences, but also the ones who are just going through regular drills.
Right, regular drills, and not to mention all the other stuff that goes on in a young person's life, and exacerbated by the fact that you have to be in fear often at school.
But if you went to the archives of the Roundtable, after all these other incidents, people would be having the exact same conversation. Mm-hmm. I've had the exact same conversation here, and not a thing has changed. Mm-hmm. And I just think our political system seems unable to take on big things and make big changes.
Despite what Jim says, this is all new content. We'll be back with more of it right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you on this Monday morning, a very busy Monday morning as we talk about many events taking place. We have a letter from Vincent who says opponents of reasonable gun safety regulations often say that mass shootings are a mental health problem, not a gun problem. The reality is that it's both. Serious mental health issues married to easy access to guns, a toxic mix.
Well, no one is saying we shouldn't invest in mental health services, right? But right. First thing we should do is probably buy back some of these guns. And it's not like one or the other. You know, I think this is the problem is this has become a popular false narrative in which the American people are being told, oh, you should choose between tighter gun regulation or mental health policies. It's both. We need both of these things. And also, here's a fun, depressing fact I like to share that brings together guns and health. It is cheaper to buy an entry AR-15 than it is to buy an EpiPen.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, EpiPens now are like $650. Entry AR-15 is $400.
Wow. And
it tells you what we care about.
Well, it does.
Yeah.
It does. And wow, that's striking. As far as this issue goes, and especially with what's happening at Brown University, I mean, I am struck, and we haven't discussed this too much as part of our conversation, but I am struck by the, I apologize if I get in trouble. Given the number of incidents that we have and given the many patterns that we see, I think it becomes troubling when we're not better than at capturing those mm-hmm. who are responsible. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there are people who are listening to me right now and saying, especially in law enforcement, and saying, well, look, this is, you know, needle in a haystack, and you have one picture that you're going on, which, quite frankly, may not even be accurate. We don't even know that, quite frankly. A video of him, of the suspect, assuming man, going by the camera wearing black. And I just don't know, you know, you think we would have more. And again, I'm not Monday morning quarterbacking this, but things like the door to the building was open. There was no security on the outside of having a key card. Apparently, according to the mayor, anyway. Things like that surprise me, given the prevalence right. of what we have been going through, that those things continue to fall through the cracks.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Like, given our loose gun laws, we should have tighter security. But at the same time, we should live in a world in which we don't have to rely on these downstream interventions because we have stronger upstream policies, right, that address gun control in general, right? Like the shooter preparedness industry is like $3 billion, right? Like we could also have a world in which we didn't have a shooter preparedness industry, right, where we didn't have to supply schools with like these key card access and shields and all these things. And you know, the thing with key card, so my building is key card access only. And honestly, it changes the culture of an institution when you cannot have open doors and a relationship with the community and trust with the community and the public. I think we lose a lot when we put in all of these measures anticipating the next mass shooting. We lose a lot of like trust in each other and a sense of community, and it really diminishes the experience, and really I think partly it does diminish the quality of education.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think that, you know, because of acts of terrorism and then also mm-hmm. these kinds of shootings, we live in an increasingly like a fortress society. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've seen this with our embassies around the world that didn't always used to be fortresses. They used to be more open to the public. And that was an important part of actually carrying out diplomacy. And for reasons that are understandable, they have become, they not only have gotten locked down, they've been moved out to the middle of a field somewhere and surrounded by high fences, and nobody wants to go to them. But more and more, our college campuses, mm-hmm. our schools, our public institutions. I can remember when I worked in the state Senate that, you know, pre-9/11 days, mm-hmm. you know, there was some security.
Come and go whenever you want.
But it was the people's house.
Yeah.
And now it's a gauntlet to go through it. And again, I can understand how we got there. But to Catherine's point, what does this say about us as a society and the ways in which we live our lives and relate to one another?
But, you know, in some respects, the key card issue mm-hmm. is sort of false safety, because if it's the student,
mm-hmm. right,
they've got the card. They can get
well,
in.
Well, right. And if you hold the door for someone else
right.
or a million different
right.
things. And I'm not saying that that's a panacea, but it does surprise me when we come upon these stories of what often the lack of security.
There was a think piece in the Times, I think it was, by someone who went to Brown and is now on their board, and how safe he felt on campus. And this was never an issue. And he used to keep his door unlocked for his friends at night in case they needed a place to crash. And I remember that too, you know. And so this whole notion of, oh, we've got to clamp everything down, it does have an impact mm-hmm. on the psyche of the school.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I start teaching again and I know that I'm going to have to pull out my card to get into wherever, Husted, you know, to do that. And it really does, it puts a damper on this notion of academic freedom when we have to mm-hmm. like, you know, use a key card to get into the building in order to teach.
Yeah, I agree. I understand everything you're saying, and I'm not arguing for the sake of arguing. However,
why not?
We lock our houses, we lock our cars. Why do we do that? Because we don't want people entering our houses or entering our cars.
We used to not have to.
Well, of course, but you still do it because, you know, if your computer is on a bag on the front, you know, you don't just put up a sign on the outside of the Corolla that says, you know, steal me. And no, I understand all of that, but I do wonder, just given where we are, that those things continuing. And I'm not saying that in any way, shape, or form that if any of this had been followed, that we wouldn't be in the exact same place we are now. I realize that, of course, without a doubt. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll discuss more. There's more horrors in the world. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about them right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Very nice to have you with us on this Monday morning, and a lot to talk about on this Monday morning. We have a couple of letters that I would just like to talk about in regards to our conversation about guns just a moment ago. I sat Sunday morning and shed tears over the senseless killings until we stopped fearing, hating, and being manipulated to, quote-unquote, other each other, and truly learned to care for one another. This will never change. People should not die for wanting an education or for celebrating their faith. Jeffrey said, among the factors leading to these tragedies, we have to acknowledge that there appears to be this conditioning in our society where too many see violence as the appropriate first response to personal conflicts. Mm-hmm. Jade said, women have mental health issues. It is mostly angry, straight white men who commit these horrendous crimes. And then Kevin said, I've always thought that if nothing changed after Sandy Hook, things will never change. And I think there are many who agree with that. It's what's going to cause a tidal shift. Gideon says, I used to believe that the well-regulated militia clause of the Second Amendment had meaning, but when I look it up, it turns out that numerous Supreme Court decisions from many, many years ago have dismissed that clause as basically meaningless. Nevertheless, it makes perfect sense that there should be a clause to regulate the possession of military-grade weapons by private people, and we need to do what we can to change that.
Yeah, Justice Scalia, in a decision about 15 years ago, and bear in mind, Scalia is one of the prime originalists, or was on the Supreme Court. He issued a majority opinion that basically said, pay no attention to the militia clause of the Second Amendment. Just pay no attention to it.
I mean, and where does it stop if you can get military grade weapons? Well, should you be able to get a flamethrower or a mortar, or maybe
fifty caliber machine?
Maybe we could buy a tank. I mean, it's an absurd argument, and yet Elon it's not seen as absurd,
right? Yeah. And let's not forget when the military offloads its stuff that they don't need anymore, the local police departments gobble that stuff up so that they can play soldier too. And we saw that in Saratoga Springs, year after year with Black Lives Matter. You know, they bring out the big things.
But they, Libby, they also do have an objective problem now and then of being outgunned in some of these incidents.
Yes.
When somebody shows up at a school with an AR-15 and all the police have is a single shot weapon of some kind.
That, Fred, but when it's a protest that's constitutionally protected and they don't like what the people are saying, like the BLM protests in Saratoga Springs, and they bring out the big tank thing that they got from the Army.
Black Lives Matter.
Yeah. I mean, it's like it's overkill, but it's, again, white, straight men doing their thing to protect the businesses downtown.
And then that feeds into people's fear that, they should be armed because look what the police has. Look what the government has. Yeah.
So we don't often get just the perfect letter, but Suzanne, for decades I've been hearing people claim that they need all of these guns in case they have to rise up against a tyrannical government. Okay, so where are you?
Right?
Isn't this your moment, or is that not what this is about after all?
No.
Mm.
I think that's a
correct
letter from Suzanne. All right, let's move on. We also have letters about what happened in the tragedy that happened in Australia, and I would like to talk about that as well. And a father and son are suspected gunmen in the Australia attack that killed 15, according to officials, and more information coming out about this. This is at a Hanukkah celebration at Bondi Beach in Australia. It's designated the attack as a terrorist incident that targeted the city's Jewish community. The ages of the victims range from 10 to 87, according to officials. Authorities identified one of the shooters as a 50-year-old man who was also killed, and the suspected second gunman as his 24-year-old son, who has been hospitalized and is likely to be charged in the attack. The older man arrived in the country on a student visa in 1998, while his son is an Australian-born citizen. Police also have said they have recovered and disarmed two improvised explosive devices from the scene of Sunday's attack, and that from the Washington Post. This was obviously a tragedy. The information coming out again from the Washington Post. The attack unfolded about 6:45 p.m. Sunday during this event marking the first day of Hanukkah at Archer Park, a grassy area near the beach. The police commissioner said that more than 1,000 people had gathered for the celebration when the attack took place. The Australian Broadcasting Corporation named the father and son accused in the attack. And as I said, one killed, one hospitalized. The father killed, the son hospitalized. Police acknowledged the names had been published in local media and did not dispute them, but said that they would not release names until the living suspect was charged and the deceased had been formally identified. Officials vowed to pursue tougher gun laws in the wake of the shooting, which we spoke about earlier, including potential firearms licensing reforms, as police confirmed one of the shooters was a gun club member and held a license for the sporting style weapons that appeared to be used in the attack.
Joe, I would just note something that I have not seen in any of the press reporting on this this horrific incident. I've seen no reference to the presence of Australian police while this celebration was taking place. You've got 1,000 people gathered celebrating Hanukkah in a country where in 2024 there were no fewer than 2,000 anti-Semitic incidents. In this year, there have been 1,600. Australia has become a hotbed of anti-Semitism. And 1,000 people gathered and no police presence. It takes a bystander jumping out of his car to tackle one of the gunmen. You know, what is this? How is this remotely explainable?
It's that part of it's not explainable at all, but it's open season on Jews. It's just that simple. And I know people aren't going to want to hear this, but it's just that simple. And I have said on the show many times that it takes a fine mind to know the difference between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. But I can tell you this, the anti-Zionist rhetoric that we're hearing every single day is fueling the anti-Semitism. That's what's coming. They are now meshed together, and Jews everywhere are now under threat because of it. Things are happening in France, things are happening in Germany. You've got the reemergence of the right wing in Europe. We make up 0.2% of the world's population. 0.2. You know, I mean, I'm like, are we really that big of a threat to everybody? Anti-Semitism and misogyny are the two oldest hates in the world, and neither one of them are particularly letting up anytime soon. But what happened in Sydney is endemic to what is happening around the world in terms of how Jews are viewed, and the anti-Zionist rhetoric that Israel doesn't deserve to exist is fueling a lot of these anti-Semitic attacks. Now, you talked about one of the kids at Brown was in Parkland. One of the oldest guy who was killed in Australia was a Holocaust survivor.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And he is taken out by an anti-Semite. You know? I mean, this is the kind of stuff that you just can't make it up.
I think the New York City Police Commissioner, of all people, had a very nice comment about all of this. And I'll just quote it. Quote, "This is not an isolated incident. No. It is part of a wider assault on Jewish life. Jewish communities are being forced to confront a threat that is persistent, adaptive, and, as evidenced yet again, global in scope," unquote.
And, you know, at my synagogue, we have to pay a lot of money. I think it's like $150,000 a year or something like that for ongoing security.
Wow.
7 days a week, because we have childcare. A child care center, early education center. So that's, you know, part of the security. But every single day we need to have security. I went to services on Saturday, and, you know, you thank the guy who's standing outside in the freezing, and he's like, "Oh, I got plenty of layers on." But I never in my wildest dreams thought that this is where we would be, that we have to have armed guards at synagogues in the United States of America.
But I also,
but we do.
I never thought that we would have official leadership that would be consorting with the kind of people you were describing mm-hmm. with in Europe, for instance.
Yeah.
Some of these
oh, yeah.
right-wing parties that are not shy at all about
Absolutely.
Spewing the most vile anti-Semitic message. And, you know, many of them, if they're not in power, are on the verge
That's
of
right.
coming into power soon in some of the key states across Europe. And so we have, just in the past few days, the Undersecretary of State, the U.S. Undersecretary mm-hmm. of State for Public Diplomacy, meeting with some of these people in Germany, with the AFD. We have, you know, in Trump 1.0, during Charlottesville, when you have people right. marching through the streets mm-hmm. of Charlottesville, Virginia, with torches chanting, the Jews will not replace us. And the response is, there's very fine people on both sides.
Right. This, he's complicit in all of this.
And so this whole atmospherics, this is, you know, I hear what you're saying, Libby, about, you know, other issues and how, you know, post October 2023, this has, you know, gotten fueled even more. But, you know, not only is anti-Semitism a longstanding ancient hatred, but what we see in recent times, I mean, in the past 10 years, predates the Hamas attack as well. I mean, they've become intertwined in many ways, particularly in American politics. But we also we have a failure of leadership
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That I really could not have imagined.
Tree of Life in Pittsburgh happened before October 7th.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of stuff that's happened before October 7th. So we can't blame October 7th. We can't blame Israel's response to this, to October 7th, for these attacks. The fact of the matter is that people hate Jews. They just do. And it's an irrational hate, and it's based on fear, like, oh, they're going to take my guns away, right? Oh, the Jews are going to come over, and they run the banks, and they're going to take over my life, and they're going to make me do things, and they're going to take all my money, and blah, 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 all the ridiculousness, you know, that we keep hearing over and over and over again about the Jewish community. So it's yes, Trump is complicit in this, as far yeah. as I'm concerned.
And we're not hearing these things in just in back rooms or in quiet conversations.
No.
One of the stars on the right,
Nick Fuentes right.
is saying things out loud.
Tucker Carlson, all of them.
That are so far mm-hmm. beyond the pale of anything I would imagine that would be said in the public sphere. And it's not receiving the level of condemnation
no.
that it deserves.
I mean, it's wild that we give them a platform, right? It's,
At all.
It's insane. And even if you provide people platforms so that there can be critique and conversation, there's no need for that, because you are just throwing gasoline onto this fire. And what has been incredibly upsetting with this administration, among many things, right, is that they like Trump will switch back and forth, like being against anti-Semitism when it's convenient for him. And then the rest of the time, through his actions, you see who he's aligned with, right? He's aligned with Nazis.
It's amazing that, you know, his son-in-law,
Jared Kushner,
is complicit with all of this.
Mm-hmm.
He's out there trying to negotiate, what, in Ukraine? I'm like, give me a break. Where did he come from all of a sudden? Because they went away for a really long time, and because they lost all their friends and they moved down to Miami and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, you don't hear the Kushners speaking out against the anti-Semitism, that's for sure. You don't hear Trump saying much of anything about it, because
Isn't Jared
he really
Kushner Jewish?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Ivanka converted to marry Jared.
And they're not saying anything.
No,
Stephen
not really.
Miller not saying anything.
No, no, they're not. They're not. And when you hear chants like globalize the Intifada, people don't know what that means, or from the river to the sea. They really don't get it. They really don't understand what that means, other than this is about Jews and wanting to victimize Jews and kill them. It's really, you know, I hate to be this way, but it really is just that simple. You know, I and I've said this before, too. I am so glad my parents aren't here to see any of this. You know, my father fought in the war. My mother grew up and in a secular, I mean, both my parents were sort of secular Jews. You know, we did the food, you know, we did Passover, we lit the candles, but they weren't religious at all. But they knew what anti-Semitism was because they grew up in the 20s and 30s mm-hmm. and 40s and they saw it and they experienced it. Mm-hmm. And I'm just so glad they're not here to see any of this because I think it would just kill them. Mm-hmm. I mean, because my father fought against fascists, and here we are welcoming them into the White House.
Hmm. When we welcome your letters, by the way, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'd love to hear from you on this and the other issues we're discussing this morning. And obviously more information will come out about this attack. But Fred, give us a sense of where this happens and sort of the overall context of the back and forth of really what's happening in the Middle East and the ripple effect across the globe, including in Australia and even in the United States.
Yeah, I think Joe, one thing that has complicated things, and I agree. I mean, this is anti-Semitism is an obscenity that goes back over 1,500 years. It did not begin on October 7th, 2023. That is absolutely correct. What complicates matters somewhat, and what exacerbates things a bit is the attitude of the current government of Israel that really, really does not want to make the point that you are free to criticize us, you are free to criticize our policies, and we will not consider you to be anti-Semitic. In a way, this government has used anti-Semitism to try to defend policies that many people consider to be indefensible. So I think this is when we talk about leaders not speaking up about this problem. I think the leaders of Israel could take a much more healthy attitude about this problem than they are right now.
Barbara writes, it's very telling that one of the witnesses to the Australian tragedy said that first, he could not believe what was happening because this is not America. Is this an image of our country to be proud of? That from our listener this morning. We've got about 5 minutes or so. As I mentioned at the top of the show, another big story, of course, over the weekend was the death of Rob and Michelle Reiner, who were killed in their Los Angeles home. And we expected that because there was no active investigation outside of what was happening in the home and there was no forced break-in, that the police were said that more information was forthcoming. And that has started to emerge as day breaks on the West Coast. Rob Reiner's son, Nick, has been taken into custody, being held on $4 million bail. And he is accused of killing his mother and father with a knife, apparently slitting their throats.
Oh, my God.
Before he was arrested, authorities reported Nick was being questioned by the Los Angeles Police Department's Robbery and Homicide Division. Still, a lot of this is emerging, and much of it is not has been confirmed by police agencies. However, has been reported by several news agencies. Nick Reiner has been taken into custody. Rob and Michelle were killed in their home on Sunday the 14th. They were found in the afternoon by their daughter. And the daughter apparently then tipped off police that there that she was concerned about her brother and his well-being, and that then Nick was being questioned by the Los Angeles Police Department. We should also note that Nick, in fact, even a film by Rob Reiner was done on this of. That Nick has spoken out about his struggles with addiction and homelessness and a lot of really deeply troubling behavior in his past that was a part of the family dynamic. And so, as I said, more information. And I just wanted to, just because I feel I would not be doing my job if I didn't. The President of the United States wrote on Truth Social, "A very sad thing that happened last night in Hollywood. Rob Reiner, a tortured and struggling but once very talented movie director and comedy star, has passed away together with his wife Michelle, reportedly due to the anger he caused others through his massive, unyielding, and incurable affliction with a mind-crippling disease known as Trump derangement syndrome."
Can't this man have any sense of decorum or compassion or anything?
Short answer to that is no.
No, I know, but geez.
I'll just finish.
You do that. I'm sorry.
There's more?
I'm only halfway through the rant. Sometimes referred to as TDS, Trump Derangement Syndrome. He was known to have driven people crazy, shouty caps, by his raging obsession of President Donald J. Trump, with his obvious paranoia reaching new heights as the Trump administration surpassed all goals and expectations of greatness, and with a new age of America upon us, perhaps like never before. May Rob and Michelle rest in peace.
Man, every day is a little worse.
What do you say? I know speechless doesn't work very well on radio, but I just am absolutely speechless.
That is
just a sociopathic thing to write and have out in the public when you're president of the country. Forget being president. Who does that?
Well, also, especially if, and I know he's not waiting for details, but the fact is that obviously there was trouble within. If what is being reported is true, there was great trouble within the family with a son. I think many of us have dealt with that in various aspects of our own lives and in our own families. And to have that trivialized in this way seems to be especially awful. But again, for it to come from the President of the United States at a time when others across the country are grieving the loss. We have about 15. Can we hold it to the after the break? Excellent. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more about this. Jim has something to say, and I'm sure you do too. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. And we would love to hear from you. First, we'll get a news update from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Before the break, we were talking about the passing of Rob Reiner and his wife, Michelle, who were killed on Sunday. And now it is, believed that they were, police say that their son, Nick, is being held in connection with the stabbing of both parents, that Rob Reiner was 78 and his wife Michelle was 68 and were victims of the attack, and so that the arrest is now going through, and that's being reported by several news agencies. This morning, we also read within the last hour, the Truth Social post by the President of the United States, Donald Trump, who blamed Rob Reiner for his own death in the Post, saying that it was because of Reiner's Trump derangement syndrome. And
so disgusting.
And Jim Ketterer was ready to make a point as before we went to break.
Jim is very eager to endorse the president's statement.
I'm eager to say something. Well, I just want people to imagine that if that statement came out from anyone else, let's say the head of the local chamber of commerce or a town supervisor or a member of Congress or den mother for a bunch of Cub Scouts or whatever, if anybody else put that out, it would be across the board condemned, as it should be. And the mental stability of the author would be questioned. So for those in the listening audience who support the sitting president, could you write into us and explain to me how this is even remotely acceptable? Could you explain to us why you could look past this and many other such statements from the President of the United States? I happen to believe, and I thought that for a long time many Americans believed, that words matter, especially when they come from the President, that character matters, that response in the wake of tragedy matters. And so how is this acceptable? Maybe someone could clear this up for us.
Libby?
It's not acceptable, but this man has changed political discourse in this country and has made the unacceptable acceptable coming out of his mouth. And part of it is because his base isn't going to criticize him because he hates the same people they hate. And so they feel like they've got a big daddy protecting them. And, you know, you want Trump derangement syndrome? This is it. This is it. He's the one who's a little on the deranged side, or a lot on the deranged side. And what he has done to the body politic in this country is going to take a very long time. It's going to mean a generational shift. To be able to come back possibly to where we were. But the other thing that feeds into this, you know, you talk about, well, where's the media, where's this? The media, we see what's happening to print media. They're being taken over by hedge funds and, you know, they've become corporate media. We're seeing these massive monopolies happening. And so the media, the people at the top, just want to make sure that they're bank accounts get bigger, and the way to do that is to ameliorate somebody like Trump and not to go after him. Now, we'll see what happens at CBS. Barry Weiss is there. I think lots of people are going to leave, and the vaulted news of Edward R. Murrow and William Paley, I mean, those are the two, right? I read a lot of journalistic history. It's the nerd in me. That's what I like to read, you know? And it's going to be destroyed overnight. We have MS Now. I'm not sure what that's about. Maybe it was just the rebranding. But at least Rachel Maddow is still on the air, speaking truth to power. But then you have Fox in every diner in every state in this country. And people are watching it. And more and more people are watching it because it's easy to digest. Thinking about all of this stuff is hard, and you have to think, and you have to analyze, and you have to question. And the majority of these people don't want to have to do that. They just want to be told what to think.
Yeah, Jim, I've been thinking about how somebody might write, what somebody might say if they wrote in to try to answer your question, to explain their view of what the president has just said. And all I can say is based on Trump supporters I know, friends of mine, you know, people with whom I can actually have a political conversation, but people who definitely voted for Donald Trump and definitely think he's doing a good job as president. What they would say, I'm quite sure, because I've heard it from them in other contexts after other statements, is, yes, you know, Donald Trump has a way of putting things that can often be very, very off-putting. I wish he would say things differently. Sometimes it can be quite offensive, but that's just the way he speaks. That's Donald Trump.
So
you need to put that aside and respect the fact that he's doing a great job as president of the United States.
So do you think those folks would, if these same words had come out of the mouth of Barack Obama or Bill Clinton?
You're quite right. There would have been universal condemnation.
Right.
But for what they're I'm not sure that they're hypocrites. I mean, these people would have thought that Barack Obama was doing a terrible job in any event if he had said something outrageous.
But just the words themselves, they would have condemned.
They would have condemned.
And they would have thought this is insane.
In this case, they might do something close to condemnation. They might say, "Yeah, these are terrible words. He never ever should have made this kind of statement in connection with the death of Rob Reiner and his wife."
Yeah.
But we're willing to set them aside precisely because he's doing such a fantastic job.
But he's losing his base around affordability. That's clearly happening. That the MAGA base is between healthcare and not having enough money to buy for Christmas presents and dinner. He's starting to lose part of his base. It's the folks who are well off and don't have to worry about money because their 401k is doing so well, who voted for him, who will keep voting for him.
Mm-hmm. And I want to go back to what you were saying, Fred. And I have a lot of Trump supporters in my family, and that's exactly what people do. They excuse or minimize certain behaviors and statements when it tarnishes their perception of him. They're like, "Oh, well, you know, he's just speaking out of turn. It's really not that big of a deal, you know." And the hoops that people jump through to even excuse something like January 6th, it's like, "Well, why do we have to keep talking about that?" And I'm like, "You've got to be kidding me." But there is this selective process, right, where it's like, well, if it doesn't fit with their image of Trump, well, they're just going to minimize it, dismiss it as some idiosyncratic behavior.
Yes.
But this goes, I mean, we were talking about culture before, as we started on the show of a gun culture, but if someone is not of your political liking and has views that are very strong, and I think it is very safe to say that Rob Reiner has been a very successful advocate and activist on a wide range of issues, that in some way he then deserves his death because of those views that he possesses. And that's the thing that scares me, that is so troubling about what the president said. Here's the other thing I hate more than anything else: that we're talking about the president instead of Rob Reiner and his wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm.
I mean, these were two people who did incredible, amazing things, redefined Hollywood, were indeed activists and advocates, and yet here we are talking about this garbage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. Rob Reiner, I mean, some of my favorite movies were his movies, you know, and Meathead, and, well, I mean, I'm old enough to remember All in the Family and all of that stuff, and his first marriage to Penny Marshall, you know, Gary Marshall, right, from Laverne and Shirley, and what he did for Hollywood was part of the renaissance that it needed to change the way, you know, we look at film and tell stories and all that sort of stuff. And he's Carl Reiner's son, so he's going to have to be funny. I mean, there's just no two ways about that, right? And he was very, very funny. But getting back to the name that we don't want to speak, the fact that he says what he says, oh, it's Trump derangement syndrome, gives license to the crazies among his followers who have all those guns we were talking mm-hmm. about before to act out. And I think we'll see more of that. I think we will see more of that.
Well, yeah, it's like lowering the bar to
yes
for decency. I mean, there isn't any decency. I mean, really, the bar is subterranean, but it is shaping the American culture in a way that is going to be really difficult to undo once hopefully we get new leadership, right? Like, this is creating a kind of meanness among us that I really hate what, you know, we have become, right? And to have the president condone this sort of behavior, encourage this behavior.
And engage in this behavior.
Yeah. What is it going to do to our society? And the young people who, these are their formative years, and this is how they see leadership, right? I have a research assistant, and really memory of American politics is the early era of Trump till now. And I was like, oh my gosh, you have no idea, right? That we used to be a totally different country. I mean, mm-hmm. we've always had issues, but you know, now the lack of decency now is really abhorrent.
I mean, that's Barack Obama was condemned for wearing a tan suit
one
time. And you know, this guy's going to skate on, you know, this is just one Truth Social post of many, many, many. Wow. You can every day you can pick out something that is indicative of lack of decency mm-hmm. is
lack
kind of the
civility.
Nicest thing that you and civility, lack of stability.
Yeah, well, mm-hmm. that too.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll be back and wrap up the show. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion, which we wrap up in a few moments. And we have a great group this morning, Catherine Tan, Libby Post, Jim Ketterer, and Ambassador Fred Hoff. And, of course, excuse me, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, so by the way, now the New York Times is also, I guess the Los Angeles Police Department has made it official. But the Reiner's son has been arrested after Rob Reiner and his wife were found stabbed, and Nick Reiner is being held in jail on $4 million bail, according to those jail records and reported by the New York Times. I want to go to just one more topic here before we call it a morning. And let's talk a little bit about President Trump has vowed to retaliate after U.S. troops were killed in Syria. A joint U.S.-Syrian security patrol was attacked in the city of Palmyra. And is that correct on the pronunciation of that, Palmyra? The Pentagon and Syria's state news agency reported this. I am reading from the Washington Post. The president vowed to retaliate for the deaths of two U.S. soldiers and an American civilian interpreter in central Syria on Saturday over the weekend in an attack on a joint U.S.-Syrian security patrol that officials blamed on the Islamic State militant group. Three other U.S. soldiers and two members of Syria's security forces were injured, according to U.S. officials and Syria's state news agency. What do we do, Fred, to keep our troops safe?
This is a tough one. We many Americans are probably not aware of this, but we still have about 1,000 uniformed personnel on Syrian territory. Their mission is to assist indigenous forces in keeping ISIS, the Islamic State, in Syria, bottled up. ISIS arose as a major organization around the 2014 timeframe. It took over most of Eastern Syria. it took over most of Iraq in a sudden invasion in which Iraqi forces just collapsed. And since that time, beginning with President Obama, we've had forces in Syria and American air forces. Both the Air Force and Naval Aviation have played a major role in trying to suppress this organization. During Trump 1, the so-called caliphate of the Islamic State was destroyed. But there are still several thousand people belonging to this this organization roaming around the deserts of Syria trying to start up an insurgency. As long as we have troops on the ground there, and I think our intention is ultimately to turn this problem over to Syria once the right internal arrangements can be made. But as long as we have troops on the ground in Syria, we should expect casualties. There is no such thing as a surgical military operation. People will be killed. Suppressing ISIS is very, very important, I think. We can see the history of how this organization operated. But again, I think, notwithstanding the president's threat of major retaliation, it's not clear against whom that retaliation would take place. And I think the administration will probably work very hard to have American troops out of Syria before the end of this administration.
Joe, can I also
yes,
jump
please.
In? So we have also had, alongside those troops, we've had people from the State Department and other agencies there over these many years as well. And the diplomacy in that case is not, what people might be thinking about when they hear the word diplomacy, negotiations around a conference room table or something like that. It really is about gathering information, establishing and maintaining relationships. I mean, really having a handle on what's going on in this particular place. And several of our key diplomats who were career foreign service officers who were doing this work out there in harm's way were abruptly removed a few weeks ago with no explanation. I can remember talking to Fred about that and saying, this is not a good sign. I'm not saying that's connected to this particular attack, but it is it's a sign that I think there's real chaos in the administration in trying to figure out how to go forward. Also, the current leadership is in Syria. It's very fragile. They don't control the whole country. That's why we still have troops there. And there's a lot of cooks involved in this kitchen from outside forces in Syria. It's a very complicated situation and very volatile.
Yeah, it's been a year since the Assad regime was overthrown, and we still do not have an ambassador and an embassy team in Syria. This is an act of pure diplomatic malfeasance. We need someone there who is able to influence the current leadership and able to report back to Washington as to the facts on the ground. A year has gone by. We still haven't done it.
In the minute and a half that we have left, is it, which I'm sure is too little time, but as the president's vows revenge for this, how does that take shape? What does that look like?
I don't know, Joe. I don't know how that takes shape. There are, if indeed ISIS was responsible for this, apparently some disaffected member of the Syrian security forces who harbored ISIS sentiments and was about to be fired. I'm not sure how revenge actually unfolds. We're talking about several thousand fighters in small groups spread over the Syrian desert, maybe inside of some towns. It's not clear how you put together a military operation that amounts to a major revenge for an operation like this.
I also think it's going to be, look, there's the shiny object over there, and I'm showing how virile I am by you know, blowing up something in Syria while over here I'm really destroying your livelihood. I mean, and that's, we see that all the time with this, with this guy. There's the shiny object to get people's attention away from the real damage he's doing.
Well, he's trying to frame himself as like the president for creating like peace or whatever, right? And so, but I think you're absolutely right. Like by pointing to all of these war efforts abroad, he can distract like from the real issues that are impacting his voter base here.
Right, like healthcare.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about all of you, but I just feel like today's show was a real pick-me-up.
You know, when we talk about the news, it's just the way it goes.
I know, but I will say that I cherish the thoughts of all of you coming into this room today and being with us and discussing these very important issues. Catherine Tan, Jim Ketterer, Ambassador Fredhoff,
I knew I was getting choked up.
And Libby Post. Thank you all very, very much. We certainly appreciate all of your efforts. We'll be back and continue with an incredible special, Candles Burning Brightly, in our 11 o'clock hour coming up after this.